You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Mine, All Mine by Nicholas Niarchos. By the early 2010s, Gertler was at the zenith of his influence, but his reputation had begun to sour. A London financier who worked with him said, "We all knew he was a scumbag. He was someone who was malevolent." At one point, the financier went to visit Gertler in his suite at the Ritz in London. He oozed evil. Meanwhile, global demand for cobalt and copper was accelerating as battery-powered devices like cell phones became a necessity for modern life. And yet Congo remained poor and conflict-racked. Many American firms, wary of corruption and instability, decided to stay away from business dealings in the region. During this same period, however, China, which was intensifying its quest to build electric cars to reduce pollution in its cities, jumped at the opportunity to get a handle on the supply chain. Beijing hammered out deals with Kabila to build roads and hospitals in exchange for mining rights. 25 years ago, we did not look over a horizon to say China's going to become an economic power whose interests are not aligned with ours, Sanderson, the U.S. diplomat, reflected. A lust for cheaper goods, cheaper electronics, had blinded Washington to Beijing's increasing control throughout the late 2000s and early 2010s. That's not to say everyone ignored the opportunity to make a buck in one of the world's poorest countries. Among the deployers of foreign capital eager to invest in the boom years was the giant New York hedge fund Auxif, since rebranded as Sculptor Capital. Years later, Auxif, too, would plead guilty to paying bribes in several African countries, including Congo. It was alleged that the hedge fund used a foreign agent to funnel at least $25 million to an unnamed Congolese official. That official's resume matched Katumba's, and the agent was a fixer whom the Justice Department described only as an Israeli businessman with significant interest in Congo's copper and diamond mining sectors. Media outlets and NGOs later identified that agent as Gertler, though he was never charged in the case. The DRC landscape is in the making, and I am shaping it like no one else, the agent wrote in an email recovered by federal prosecutors. In 2012, Katumba died in a plane crash. Gertler told people, including his Auxif investors, that he was upset. But others read his mood differently. As one text message between Moises Gertner and another friend put it, upon learning of Katumba's death, "Our friend is happy he is going to save paying a lot of money," presumably referencing the payments made from Gertler to Katumba. And so Gertler, ever searching for opportunity, refocused his efforts on Joseph Kabila. In public, Gertler hailed Kabila's efforts to run the country. "He's the most promising new president in the world, a new Mandela," he told Newsweek. But soon, Gertler also began to use the same kind of language to describe himself. "I should get a Nobel Prize," Gertler told journalists from Bloomberg in 2012. "They need people like us who come and put billions in the ground. Without this, the resources are worth nothing." By this time, Gertler had also attracted the attention of international law enforcement, and investors in Gertler's businesses were getting nervous. On December 21st, 2017, Gertler was sanctioned by the U.S. Department of the Treasury for amassing a fortune through hundreds of millions of dollars worth of opaque and corrupt mining and oil deals in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The Israeli businessman had weathered bad press, but the sanctions made him radioactive. Anyone who dealt with him now ran the substantial risk of running afoul of U.S. law. In 2018, Glencore stopped paying the royalties, estimated to be around $77,000 a day or $28 million annually that Gertler was entitled to under Congolese law. Gertler initiated legal proceedings, claiming almost $3 billion in past and future royalties. In early 2018, Glencore executives knew they were caught between a rock and a hard place. Chinese enterprises had been buying up copper and cobalt mines all over southern Congo, and if Glencore were to stop paying Gertler, they would all lose their cash cows. And the Chinese would be there just waiting to snap it up, as one Glencore official put it. On the other hand, Glencore executives feared their company might be targeted by the U.S. government because even though the company was based abroad, they were paying Gertler in U.S. dollars. Ultimately, the company sent a team of negotiators to Washington to devise a solution. As a company based in Switzerland, could they pay Gertler in a different currency, such as euros? No objection was raised, and business with Gertler, the mines, and the implicit blessing of the United States government went on as usual. It was not as if Gertler was happy about the arrangement. In an interview with the Israeli paper Haaretz, two former auditors at a Congolese bank told journalists that they saw Gertler and his associates on various occasions enter the bank around that time with sacks, suitcases, and a bill counter. Soon afterward, they noticed large movements of money in accounts that were supposedly unconnected to Gertler. That was clearly an attempt to evade the sanctions, one of them said. At the end of the 2010s, it became clear that Beijing had stolen a march on Washington. The U.S. began to wake up to how many of Congo's resources, especially cobalt, were controlled by the Chinese. President Joe Biden ordered a strategic review of critical metals, and the U.S. moved away from Chinese-produced supply chains for military equipment. But by that point, China dominated in Indonesia, the second-largest producer of cobalt, and the world's largest miner of nickel, another battery mineral, and was deeply entrenched in Chile and Zimbabwe, which produced large amounts of lithium. What's more, China owned stakes in 15 of the 19 largest copper and cobalt mines in Congo. One solution, proposed both by lobbyists and the Israeli government, was to use Gertler's network. But the facts on the ground had turned against the Israeli. In 2019, Felix Tshisekedi took power in Kinshasa. Gertler was sidelined as new fixers began to reap Congo's riches. In 2022, Congo began fighting a war against a Rwanda-backed rebel group called the M23, whose political wing is led by a former Kabila loyalist. Former President Joseph Kabila, Gertler's friend and best contact, was sentenced to death in absentia in 2025 after allying himself with the rebel side. Once the arbitration case levied by Moises Amendi Gertner was in full swing in 2024, it became much clearer how exactly Gertler had amassed his vast portfolio of mining and oil assets that led to his sanctioning. He testified that he paid Katumba to distribute money in local communities and gave cash loans to the Central Bank of Congo. His lawyers maintain that such payments were in no way improper or unusual. In May 2024, the Treasury Department began exploring a limited easing of sanctions on Gertler to facilitate his departure from Congo. a proposal that would allow him to sell his holdings in copper and cobalt mines in exchange for withdrawing from the country entirely. The Biden administration offered to lift sanctions on Gertler if he left Congo, but negotiations stalled, and his continued presence in the country remains a complicating factor in American efforts to diversify its supply chains and recapture some of the gains made by the Chinese government. Last November, the U.S. Geological Survey released its third list of materials that it said were essential for national security, economic stability, and supply chain resilience. An alphabet of substances from aluminum through copper and cobalt all the way to zinc and zirconium. The list ran to 60 minerals. China now dominates the supply chain for more than half of them. The U.S. government is encouraging companies to invest in Congo's critical metals. Kobold, a startup backed by Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, agreed to buy a stake in a huge lithium mine in Congo in mid-2025. In September, reports emerged that Glencore was in talks to sell a stake in Kamoto Copper Company, one of Congo's largest copper and cobalt operations. Potential interested parties include the New York investment firm Orion Resource Partners and mining giant Rio Tinto, with potential U.S. government financing. But the talks have been complicated by Gertler's ongoing 2.5% royalty on net revenues from KCC. By some estimates, his royalties on Congolese mines will generate an average of $200,000 a day for at least another decade. An anti-corruption NGO, Global Witness, noted recently that Congo stands to learn more than $3.7 billion because of Gertler's deals, according to estimates made by the civil society coalition Le Congo N'est pas Avengé. Gertler has reportedly agreed to a version of the Biden plan. He will sell his royalties, which could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars, divest from Congo, and participate in an audit. The U.S., in turn, would provide a license that would conditionally lift the sanctions. Details are still being hashed out in Washington. The Trump administration is keen to do deals in Congo that give America long-term access to Congolese resources, including hosting a strategic reserve of U.S. cobalt in the country. Failing that, the U.S. government hopes to be able to source its stockpile of the critical metal from Congo. On January 12th, Congo sent its first export of copper to the U.S. The mine it came from, however, was majority owned by the Chinese. And what role, if any, will Gertler play? Currently, he is in Israel, waiting for his luck to change and hoping powerful friends in far-off places will change it for him. Human rights groups have already sounded the alarm. The U.S. sanctions on Gertler and his corporate network were a line in the sand in preventing further corrupt deals for Congo's multi-billion-dollar mining industry, and that line should not be erased, wrote the anti-corruption campaigners John Prendergast and Sasha Lezhnev at Just Security in October. Allowing him to return would take the DRC backwards to the free-for-all days of corrupt mining deals. Unclear as whether Gertler will go quietly or if the U.S. government is even in the business of drawing lines in the sand anymore. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with a portrait by Gil Button. Mark Jacobs, the consummate New York City designer, Sofia Coppola documentary subject, and recovering Labubu collector on his signature manicures, love for the Great Gatsby, and Edith Piaf-inspired motto. What is your idea of perfect happiness? An empty head and a full heart. What is your greatest fear? Shame. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Peter Pan. Which living person do you most admire? Dr. Richardson, my psychiatrist. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Self-consciousness. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Messiness. What is your greatest extravagance? A fresh set of nails every 3 weeks. What is your favorite journey? Putting together a show. On what occasion do you lie? When I am afraid of what telling the truth might bring. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My height. I'm short. Which living person do you most despise? That asshole. What is your greatest regret? Je ne regrette rien. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband, Charlie. Which talent would you most like to have? Mine, but greater. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I would lose my insecurities. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I'm done. I don't want to come back. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? Someone's beloved dog. What is your most treasured possession? Beautiful memories. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery, being sleep-deprived and filled with fear? What is your most marked characteristic? My personal style. Who are your favorite writers? Capote, Didion, Ellis. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Daisy Buchanan. Who are your heroes in real life? Ed Ruscha, Philip Glass, Marcel Duchamp, and Yves Saint Laurent. What is it that you most dislike? Hatred, prejudice, and hypocrisy. How would you like to die? Peacefully, in my sleep. What is your motto? To thine own self be true. What do you consider your greatest achievement? I haven't achieved it yet. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Mark Jacobs. Now here's a Vanity Fair spotlight, Thick as Thieves. Eben Moss Spackrock and John Bernthal open up to Jenny Lumette about reimagining her father's new Hollywood classic, Dog Day Afternoon. Photographer Terrell Hampton. Opening photo, yes, Chef. Eben Moss Spackrock and John Bernthal photographed at Winson in Brooklyn. And here they are sitting at a booth with a red and white checkered tablecloth. Dog Day Afternoon is the third rail of male love and loneliness, a primal scream from the sweltering streets of a stone-broke New York City. My dad, Sidney Lumet, directed the 1975 film, and his heart cracked for its anti-heroes, Sonny and Sal, played by Al Pacino and John Cazale. "They're like open wounds up there," he once said. Eben Moss Spackrock and John Bernthal will try to channel that energy on Broadway this spring in a stage adaptation written by Pulitzer Prize winner Stephen Adley Gerges and directed by Rupert Gold. Bernthal plays doomed Sonny, who's hoping to pay for his lover's gender-affirming operation. His longtime pal and co-star on The Bear plays volatile Sal, the loneliest guy in the world. Both characters feel like meaner cousins of Willie Loman, left behind men who have failed their partners, failed their children, failed themselves. Sonny's desire to take care of people is so intrinsic, it's worth fighting and dying for, says Bernthal. He is unheard. That's why he's screaming so loud. He and Moss Spackrock are barely able to contain their excitement about taking this journey together. "I believe in him with every fiber of my being," says Bernthal. Moss Spackrock returns the favor. "John is the hardest working actor I've ever worked with. He's relentless." With this production, the actors want to create something as new, bold, and explosive as American filmmaking in the 1970s. Are they nervous, though, about inhabiting two of the most kinetic American stick-up men for 8 shows a week? "It's great to be terrified," says Bernthal. "If you're not, something's deeply wrong." they beg his pardon. The freewheeling world of mercy under Trump is less a system than a pipeline of ass-kissing and piper-paying, plus a little bit of luck. William Marks tours the machine, going inside some of the most high-profile, high-stakes pardon plays, from villains of reality TV to Silk Road's libertarian mastermind, to understand the cost of freedom. Opening illustration by Andre Carrillo shows Trump holding Lady Liberty in his arms, and she's wearing a low-cut short dress with red stiletto heels, has her fingernails painted, has a red blindfold over her eyes, and obviously filler-plumped lips. And she's holding the scales of justice out and various hands. Well, they're putting money in them. Excuse me. Since 2016, President Donald Trump has granted clemency to over 1,700 people. Have mercy. Trump's roster of clemency recipients includes a range of convicted January 6th rioters, disgraced politicians, rappers, and reality television stars. Pictured here are Devin Archer, Joe Arpaio, Steve Bannon, Rod Blagojevich, Christina Bobb, Elliot Brady, Dinesh D'Souza, John Eastman, Jenna Ellis, Boris Epstein, Philip Esformes, Michael Flynn, and Michelle Fiore. As President Donald Trump's first term neared its violent denouement on the morning of January 6, 2021, in a hushed corner suite several blocks away, a Republican lobbyist placed a call to Stephanie Grisham, the First Lady's chief of staff. He needed a favor. Awaiting the inspection of White House counsel Pat Cipollone. Cipollone was a batch of critical files, this lobbyist told Grisham, that were key to the future freedom of Greg Lindbergh, an insurance mogul convicted in March 2020 of conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bribery for trying to influence a North Carolina politician. This lobbyist had already asked senior officials to examine Lindbergh's pardon application, then pass it to the president for approval. Now, just days before Trump would leave office, the lobbyist really needed Grisham to chase down that request. "No problem," she reportedly responded, "happy to do it." By the end of the day, as history knows, the West Wing where Cipollone worked was in chaos. Grisham, who had been working from home, had resigned from her job by that night. In the days that followed, Trump granted a flurry of pardons, but Lindbergh's was not among them. Grisham told Vanity Fair she didn't remember the incident. That day was crazy. An attorney for Lindbergh said pardons should be given when the facts of the case warrant it, and that a pardon is appropriate here, not just to address the lasting harm to him, but also his family and the many people who have worked with him. Cipollone did not respond to a request for comment. Nearly 5 years on, with Trump back in office, the convicted, then released, then reconvicted Lindbergh has spent big to wipe his slate clean, with advisors such as Alan Dershowitz, who joined Trump's own legal team during his first impeachment, and the advocacy efforts of Keith Schiller, Trump's former personal bodyguard. Through a web of companies Lindbergh controlled, prosecutors have alleged he defrauded insurance firms and thousands of policyholders, deceived regulators, and improperly financed a lavish lifestyle. In May 2024, a jury convicted Lindbergh of conspiracy to commit honest services wire fraud and bribery involving federally funded programs. And in November 2024, he pleaded guilty to two other offenses. Schiller's firm recently listed executive pardon in a disclosure form. Schiller did not respond to a request for comment. Lindbergh is far from the only jailbird supplicant, though others have succeeded where he so far has not. High-profile pardons or sentence reductions have flowed relatively freely from the White House, absolving many felonious power players, including Ross Ulbricht, the founder of Darknet Marketplace Silk Road, sentenced to life in prison for a criminal enterprise that conspired to distribute narcotics and for conspiracies involving computer hacking and money laundering. Reality TV star Todd Chrisley, sentenced to 12 years for charges like bank fraud and tax evasion. Binance crypto king Changping Zhao, who pleaded guilty for failing to maintain an effective anti-money laundering program, and disgraced New York Congressman George Santos, how much time do you have, along with the more than 1,500 January 6th protesters Trump pardoned only hours after resuming office. In more photos, Glenn Quesada, Julie Chrisley, illegally blonde. In 2022, Todd and Julie Chrisley were sentenced to 12 and 7 years, respectively, for conspiracy to commit bank fraud and tax evasion, among other charges. Robert Cheely, Chris Collins, Henry Cuellar, Ben Dalo, Duncan Hunter, Juan Hernandez, Alan Hostetter, Scott Hall, Rudy Giuliani. Fraud alert, Trump's former personal lawyer and New York City mayor was symbolically pardoned for his 2020 election fraud involvement. Michael Grimm, Kentrell Galdon. Other would-be pardonees whose prospects of freedom vary read like a hit list from the greatest scandals of this century. Elizabeth Holmes, Sam Bankman-Fried, whose parents have taken up his cause, the Alexanders, three brothers accused of a slew of horrifying sex crimes, which they have denied, and of course, Ghislaine Maxwell. One senior Republican congressman, James Comer, told associates he'd needed to persuade Trump that pardoning Maxwell was a bad idea. Comer's office did not respond to multiple emails seeking comment. Maxwell's one-time criminal attorney, David Marcus, when told by Vanity Fair about Comer's efforts to dissuade Trump not to pardon Maxwell, responded with a single word, "Wow." The White House pointed Vanity Fair to two videos, one from Reuters in which the president says, "I don't rule it in or out. I don't even think about it." And another on the White House's YouTube channel in which Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says, "We have a very thorough review process here that moves with the Department of Justice and the White House Counsel's Office. There's a whole team of qualified lawyers who look at every single pardon request." For the hopeful who seek indulgences from Trump like Renaissance crooks to their Pope, desirous of either pardons that entirely forgive or commutations that shorten prison time and erase fines, Trump's willingness to reimagine the pardon and commutation processes has fueled a cottage industry. It's also prompted an urgent debate over what many see as America's two-tier justice system, where the rich ride out their legal woes on a raft of cash. Supporters says he has offered Hail Marys to those whom the justice system has failed. "Guys, I'm just not going to do this," John Kiriakou claims. That's how Barack Obama reacted to his pardon request. "It's him or Manning," said the president, meaning Chelsea, the whistleblower convicted for violating the Espionage Act, who was imprisoned from 2010 to 2017 when Obama commuted her sentence. Obama did not respond to a request for comment for this story. Kiriakou, a former intelligence officer, had pleaded guilty to disclosing the identity of a covert CIA officer involved in the Bush administration's controversial Extraordinary Rendition Program. He served a 23-month sentence. After his 2015 release, He lost his government pension. Just before Obama left office, Kyriakou says that some wealthy Greek Americans tried to intervene on his behalf via Vice President Joe Biden. As a senator, Biden had voted against the 1982 Intelligence Identities Protection Act, under which Kyriakou was convicted. According to Kyriakou, Biden had gone to the mat following a dinner at the White House. It didn't work. A few years later, under a different administration, Kyriakou said that former NYPD Commissioner Bernard Kerik, himself a Trump pardonee, suggested talking to Rudy Giuliani. Trump granted Giuliani a largely symbolic pardon, though he never faced federal charges for it. Giuliani was accused of trying to overturn the 2020 election. The moment Kyriakou and his attorney broached the subject of clemency during a meeting at what was the Trump Hotel in D.C., now the Waldorf Astoria, Giuliani inexplicably dashed off to the restroom. His chief of staff said, "You never talked to Rudy about a pardon. You talked to me about a pardon, and I talked to Rudy." According to Kyriakou, the Giuliani aide told him that the fee would be $2 million, says Kyriakou, who laughed at the aide then and laughs again now. "I said, look, I don't have $2 million. I'm never going to have $2 million. And even if I did, why would I spend $2 million to cover a $700,000 pension?" Kyriakou stood up, shook hands, and left. America's mayor was still in the bathroom. Kerik passed away in May. A spokesperson for Giuliani did not comment. And more photos. Scott Jenkins, Brian Kelsey, Bernard Kerik, Kwame Kilpatrick, Charles Kushner, Troy Lake, Kathy Latham, Roger Stone, P.G. Sittenfeld, Peter Schwartz, Christian Saucier, George Santos, Rick Renzi, Stuart Rhodes. In revolt, the founder of the Oath Keepers was released from prison after he was convicted of seditious conspiracy in the January 6th attacks. As Trump dined on well-done steak with ketchup and Diet Coke, the group discussed fentanyl, cannabis, and fiscal policy. Then McArdle, in a cold, nervous sweat, made her ask. Joe Arpaio had better luck. As Maricopa County, Arizona sheriff for 24 years, Arpaio earned a national reputation for hardline policies. He forced inmates to wear pink boxer shorts and work in chain gangs and encouraged deputies to sniff out pretext to detain people and examine their immigration status, a Fourth Amendment violation he touted in press releases and on TV. Eventually, Justice Department lawyers, including trial attorney John Keller, decided there was sufficient evidence to prosecute Arpaio for criminal contempt, an unusual charge for a public office holder. In late July 2017, then 85-year-old Arpaio was convicted of willfully disregarding a judge's order. One Friday evening, a few weeks after the trial ended, Keller checked his phone as he emerged from the D.C. Metro. Trump, having teased the possibilities several times, had gone ahead and pardoned Arpaio before he was even sentenced. "I guess this is how this administration is going to operate," Keller recalls thinking. "There was no process. There was no consultation with the prosecution team. It was clearly and blatantly because of a political alliance between the public figure who was convicted and the president." It was also the first time someone Keller had prosecuted received a pardon, and the first pardon he knew of granted before sentencing. Green Beret Matthew Goldstein, accused of killing an unarmed Afghan man whom he believed was a Taliban bomb maker, has since received clemency before sentencing. So did Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, for lying to the FBI, and Steve Bannon, charged with conspiracy to commit wire fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering. In retrospect, says Keller, Arpaio was a canary in the coal mine. On January 20th, 2021, the final day of Trump's first term, Trump pardoned Republican fundraiser Elliot Broidy. whom Keller had prosecuted for violating foreign lobbyist rules. Senior Department of Justice officials had initially instructed the prosecuting team to pursue a lighter sentence against Broidy, says Keller. The DOJ did not respond to a request for comment. In January of Trump's second term, Keller had become acting chief of the Public Integrity Section, which focuses on corruption cases involving public office holders. But within weeks, Keller disagreed with the dismissal of corruption charges against then-New York Mayor Eric Adams, and he resigned. Since the start of 2025, the once-vaunted Public Integrity Team has shrunk from some 30 prosecutors to just a handful. The rooms where it happened. Alexander Hamilton encouraged the framers to enshrine the concept of mercy in the Constitution. Many presidents have used Article II powers judiciously. John Adams pardoned participants in Freeze Rebellion of 1800. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln pardoned many Union deserters. After it, Andrew Johnson blanket pardoned nearly all Confederate soldiers. Next photos, Deshaun Maddock, Paul Manafort, Mark Meadows, Kelly Meggs, Trevor Milton, Lorraine Pellegrino, Sidney Powell, Steve Stockman, Daryl Strawberry, Enrique Tarrio, Ross Ulbricht, Carlos Watson, Big Little Lies. Before his pardon, the Ozzy Media co-founder had been sentenced to 10 years for fraud. Christopher Worrell, Changpeng Zhao. Lincoln appointed a dedicated pardon clerk to deal with the huge flood of petitions stemming from the Civil War. There was a whole cottage industry of people who sprang up and were charging fees to get people pardons from President Lincoln because he was perceived to be a soft touch, says Samuel Morrison, a lawyer specializing in clemency cases. In those days, you could actually get a meeting with the president himself. It wasn't that hard to do. And so things went for the next century or so, until Gerald Ford preemptively pardoned Richard Nixon. Then George H.W. Bush pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, who had been indicted for his role in the Iran-Contra affair. Then Bill Clinton offered 11th-hour reprieves to his half-brother Roger and Democrat super-donor Mark Rich. In the roughly quarter century since, the Office of the Pardon Attorney has employed a dedicated staff with a relatively established workflow. Those requesting a pardon have been required to wait 5 years after their conviction or sentence completion before submitting letters from at least three supporters and a long application. FBI background checks involve family members, neighbors, employers, equivalent to what you would need to get a top secret security clearance, as one former pardon attorney put it. By the time Obama took office, the DOJ tightly controlled the process, says Morrison, who served 13 years in the pardon office until 2010. He says fellow bureaucrats stalled, sometimes hid, and occasionally lied about pardon applications. A couple of years after a 2012 report in the Washington Post highlighted such obfuscations, Obama launched a new clemency initiative focused on long sentences for drug-related offenses that led to more than 1,700 commutations. Yet in many states, the lives of convicted felons remain difficult when they receive only a commutation rather than a full pardon. Like millions of other formerly incarcerated people, they still live with what are known as civil disabilities. In certain states, some cannot earn a real estate license or work as a beautician. Others struggle to open investment accounts. Gimme, gimme more. The vast funds funneled into America's healthcare system each year through Medicare and Medicaid make the sprawling, complex, and fragmented industry uniquely susceptible to abuse. But even so, the scale of the $1.3 billion fraud scheme Philip S. Formes perpetrated over more than a decade was breathtaking. He dispensed bribes liberally to doctors sending patients to his facilities, for occasionally inadequate care or unnecessary treatments to a Florida state official who gave a heads up on inspections, and according to prosecutors, to a former University of Pennsylvania basketball coach who helped his son get into college. He lived in 11,000 square feet on Miami Beach, hired sex workers, lounged in luxury hotels, flew private, and cruised around in a $1.6 million Ferrari Aperta, wearing a $360,000 Grubel Forsey watch. We had hours and hours of recordings, says Alan Medina, a prosecutor who oversaw Esforme's prosecution. The guy was just abusive. Convicted on 20 of an original 28 counts, Esforme was sentenced in September 2019 to 20 years and had to forfeit more than $38 million to the federal government and another $5.5 million in restitution to Medicare. Following his indictment, his family started donating tens of thousands of dollars to a Miami-based Jewish nonprofit called the Aleph Institute that advocates for prisoners' rights. Soon after his sentencing, the Institute rallied support for a clemency campaign. And an Aleph-affiliated rabbi unsuccessfully asked the judge to let Esforme be placed in alternative supervision. An Aleph spokesperson says its advocacy for an alternative sentence for Mr. Esforme is among many hundreds of similar appeals, and that Aleph had returned the family's donations. With help from Dershowitz and support from other well-connected lawyers, including former Republican attorneys General Edwin Meese and Michael McCasey, Esforme's campaign lasted little more than a year. By late December 2020, Medina, the prosecutor, was at his in-laws' Massachusetts home for the holidays when a colleague messaged. A White House statement declared that Esforme would receive a commutation, shaving a decade off his sentence. "I couldn't believe what had happened," Medina tells Vanity Fair. "It was a punch in the gut." "This was a culmination of a lot of my career," he explains. "It was just disgusting. I'll do it. I'll free him." In the weeks after the storming of the Capitol, Ahmed Basset worked close to 18-hour days at the FBI's Washington field office to help convict several of the most violent rioters. He later oversaw the contentious conviction of two D.C. police officers. Indicted on second-degree murder, conspiracy, and obstruction charges for a suspect's death in a high-speed chase. A fellow former prosecutor described that case as a total shit show for the bad blood it created among local law enforcement. After Trump resumed office in 2025, a DOJ colleague texted Basset, "Did you read this email? I'm really sorry." Hundreds of prosecutors had received a note from the new interim U.S. Attorney for D.C., Edward Martin, proudly announcing Trump had suddenly pardoned the two cops Basset had prosecuted. What a great act by the president to protect our colleagues in these efforts to make D.C. safe, it read. Martin's official biography noted an internship on Pope John Paul II's staff. He tweeted after one pardon, "No MAGA left behind." This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. You can also ask your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.